At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Ronaldo's got that twist now and pivot in the air.
Yeah.
I look at him doing that and I'm thinking, ooh, be careful. Yeah. That's like crew shit. That's potential crew shit in the making.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts and download the OTB Sports app.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now, you're very welcome along. We have much to discuss. Ireland beaten by Scotland, which means they did not manage to finish second either in their mini group. So no second chance, no World Cup next year for Ireland. It is a long, long way from the last four in 2014. Meanwhile, opening weekend of the new shiny United Rugby Championship. Bonus point wins for Leinster and Munster against South African opposition. A bonus point win for Ulster at home to Glasgow. And then Connacht, they were on the road over in Cardiff where they lost. Very happy to say Rory O'Connor of the Irish Independent here in studio. Very welcome back.
Thank you, Joe.
Good to have you with us. Yeah. Fiona Coughlin, Grand Slam winning Irish international on the line. Hi, Fiona.
Hi, lads. How's things?
Yeah, very well. So let's start with Ireland and no World Cup. I mean, I was tempted to call this rock bottom, but of course, things may well get worse. It's a low point, that's for sure. First no World Cup since 1991, beaten by Scotland 20 points to 18. If you had told us on the eve of the Spanish match, this is what we would be looking at, you know, no automatic qualification and no second chance in the repechage, we would have been bitterly disappointed and probably questioning how that could have happened. And yet here we are.
Yeah, shocked. And to be honest with you, definitely, I thought they were favourites going into the competition based on, I suppose, the caliber of players that were there, the amount of time they've had together. In fairness, they've had a huge number of camps. And just in comparison to the other countries that were there, I just thought that they should have won it. But I know you've no given right to go out. You have to go out and play to win it. And just the number of errors, bad set piece, ill discipline, lack of game management, particularly in that Scottish game. You know, the 67th minute, they had a penalty to kick and there would have been two scores in the difference and that would have been huge. But I don't know whether the message was to kick on and look for those two extra tries for the bonus point. But yeah, it's rock bottom and I hope this is as low as we go. I hope it doesn't go any lower.
It's not the first time that we've mentioned any of those shortcomings in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, like they were identified. I know we can talk about ring rustiness in the first game against Spain, but you know, they're pretty much in the same position as us. And then to repeat it again 3 weeks later in a crucial game that you have to win. Or even draw, to be honest. And we couldn't take control of the game. It's hugely disappointing for, I suppose, those players first and foremost, but for Irish women's rugby it's hugely disappointing that we're not going to be at a World Cup next year.
Absolutely, it's unacceptable really, Fiona, isn't it? I mean, at every level that Ireland wouldn't have a team at a World Cup at senior level. It doesn't, you know, men's or women's, it shouldn't be acceptable at any level. And I think there's three strands to it. There's the players' own performances, and I think you could see a full time and those kind of almost harrowing scenes from Parma. What, you know, they'll live with this for the rest of their lives. They're not going to get over this very easily. And for those of them who are at the end of the line, this is an awful way to sign off. I know Claire Molloy is retired this evening. Like, she's, you know, an unbelievable servant to the game in Ireland, and she's signing off on an all-time low. There's the coaching element of it, and how did they not fix the issues that were so apparent through the first two games? How is their line-out so bad after three games? And then there's the overall structural part of it as well, the IRFU element of are they doing everything they can so that the Ireland women's team and women's rugby in general can thrive and can succeed? And it's not succeeding at the moment. Just an IRFU reason. Sorry, Fiona, I'll pass over to you a second. Like, it's not just the IRFU who are to blame. I think the players will blame themselves, the coaches, you would hope, will look at their own decisions. But I think there is a bigger picture discussion. If this is to be a low point and this is the moment where this is the ground zero moment where they build back up, there has to be a fairly forensic and honest and transparent review that involves people like Fiona and from, you know, from her successful generation to try and make sure that this never happens again.
Yeah, I fully agree with you on all those points. And you look at these players, and as I said, I thought they were the fittest they've ever been. You know, they've had loads of camps together. But when you talk about structural, how much game time have some of them had in the 15s game? And I'm not picking on one player, but I'll just use it as an example. Stacey Flood, who I think has unbelievable ability to be an international 15s 10, but she's had five games of 15s rugby in the last God knows how long. She's been in the sevens camp. And, you know, you can't replicate that from a game management point of view in a hugely pressurised situation. And it's not just her, it's a number of them in that situation. Or I know the Interpros, they couldn't be brought forward this year, that's fair enough. But even now, going back into it, how much game time are they going to play in the AIL? You know, I just think all those structures need to be looked at. And if the review, if they've said they're going to do a review, we did a review after 2017, don't know what came of it, don't know what changed really, and here we are again. So as you said, it has to be transparent, if not to the public, but certainly to the people involved in the game at grassroots, in clubs, and then the players that are involved at that elite level.
Well, the aims, the five-year aims spelled out in the 2018 document now look faintly embarrassing, really. So they had, what, one Six Nations title, top three otherwise, a World Cup qualification and a top six finish at the World Cup. So that was the IRFU stating their plan, their aim. I'm sure there was a degree of realism about that, and to not make the World Cup is disastrous. Ultimately, Rory, who is, because I know you were talking to different people today and Fiona do come in after this, who is charged, and this echoes of a question asked of Adam Griggs, which wasn't answered brilliantly back in the Six Nations, who is actually charged with looking after the game? Who is in the IRFU this morning dedicating their whole day to this and nothing but this?
I'm not sure there's one person whose job it is to look after justice. The director of women's rugby is Anthony Eddy, who reports to David Nusifora, who is ultimately responsible for performance at the elite end of things at the IRFU. And Anthony Eddy shares his role with the sevens. And David Nusifora wasn't in Parma on Saturday, and Anthony Eddy was off training the women's sevens team. Funnily enough, David Nusifora came in 2014 when Fiona was still playing and was in Marcoussi the day that Fiona and her team beat, certainly for the semi-final, and I think for the day they beat New Zealand. I think he was brokering the Johnny Sexton return at the time, and Johnny was there as well. But, you know, he came in at a time where Fiona's team had recently won a Grand Slam, beat New Zealand and got to the semi-final of the World Cup. And after Philip Doyle signed off, Tom Tierney took over and they won it again the following year in 2015. And since then, and partly, and I think a large part of this is to do with the fact that David Nusifora came in with a remit, or certainly a self-imposed remit, to go with the sevens program and to put so many eggs in the Olympic dream, and to try and build a men's and sevens program that can compete at the, you know, on the world stage.
Yeah.
And I think the moment that Irish women's rugby in Ireland started to go on a downward spiral, and there's partly the retirement of players like Fiona, I think, and maybe that there wasn't the structure in place to bring through the next generation of players, but it's also a decision to plough resources into the sevens team. And I remember when Tom Tierney was in charge, when three players, Alison and Miller, Senna Nuopo, and I can't remember the third, were basically taken out of the 15 squad to go off and play in the sevens tournament, we started seeing the 15s team become not the be-all and end-all, become almost a second-class citizen. And now we have a situation where there's underage structures and pathways for sevens players in Ireland, but there are no underage pathways and structures in place for 15s players in Ireland, where, and that's fine when you're finding flankers and wingers, but really, like, where's the next Fiona Coughlin going to come from? Because with all due respect to Fiona, like, sevens is not the game for props and second rows, and you're almost abandoning those tranches of players unless you put in place those pathways. So I've kind of diverged away from your question, but in my view, the people who are responsible for this, I mean, Adam Griggs is in charge of the team, he's the coach, but he's reporting to Anthony Eddy, who's basically in charge of the finite resource of elite players who play both sevens and 15s, and tells Adam Griggs when he can have them and when he can't. And this is how we got to a place where Stacey Flood was basically parachuted into the team in 2021, played in the Six Nations as a replacement for Hannah Tyrrell. Unfortunately, Hannah Tyrrell retired. She was the ninth of, I think, of 10 out halves who Adam Griggs has used over the last couple of years. And just think about Andy Farrell going to a pivotal World Cup game, which this was the equivalent of, with having used 10 out halves and settling on Ben Healy, having captained once or twice before. There'd be uproar, and there should be, like, the chopping and changing that's gone on. It just speaks to a lack of strategy, a lack of kind of, not necessarily investment of funds, but investment of time and resources into this 15s program, where, and ultimately this is a 15s country. with a sevens programme. And I think where Dave Nusafora and Anthony Eddy maybe have a cultural challenge is they're trying to turn us into a sevens country. But ultimately, the country will be judged on their 15s performance in Ireland, within Ireland. And maybe if the women had gone to the Olympics and succeeded there, we might be able to forgive them a poor World Cup performance. But I don't even think culturally that's acceptable here. I think the 15s team will always be the gold standard in Ireland, and it should always be the gold standard in Ireland.
Well, the 15s World Cup will be a big event. The Six Nations will be on national television free to air. So if your 15s is suffering, it's a really bad look for the game. Just one quick follow-up, and then really curious for your view, Fiona, on what's gone wrong here. You said there David Nusafour looks after the elite end and the high performance end, and Anthony Eddy reports to him. So Fiona's point about the lack of game time at AIL, who's fretting about the AIL structures? Who's looking after the AIL? Like, is Dave Nusafour involved in all that?
It's a women's committee, as far, and Fiona will correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not massively on top of the minutiae of IRFU and who's on each committee, but there, I think that's run at a committee level, and there will be Colin McEntee's in charge of domestic gate. This is the question that Adam Griggs couldn't answer during the Six Nations.
Yeah.
Colin McEntee's in charge of the domestic game, which I think encapsulates women's and men's All-Ireland League, and they've restructured the All-Ireland League to look like the English Premiership, a 10-team first division. It's only one division, unlike it's an elite division rather than the loads of divisions that the men have. But there's a women's committee that I don't think Anthony Eddy or David Nusafour sit on. And I think if the clubs want to get anything across, they have to use their club reps. Their club reps are often representing both the men's and women's sides of the clubs. And you can see how it's just getting messier and messier, and things are falling between the cracks. And I think there's frustration, again, Fiona can correct me if I'm wrong, at an AIL level, that they don't have access to their players, that they're not as well resourced as they could possibly be, that as the supposed feeder clubs for the international team, they're not given enough time. Like, there would be complaint that not enough time is spent at the games by the national team coaches or by Anthony Eddy and things like that. So, I mean, I don't know 100% because it's not like something I've studied in great detail, but from everyone I talked to, there just seemed to be a cloudiness about it. And let's go back to February or March when Adam Griggs just couldn't answer this question himself.
Yeah, Fiona, a cloudiness about the running of the women's game?
I think there's a disconnect. I think obviously David Nusafour and Anthony Eddy are that performance point and not coming down to the grassroots level. And we don't have those systems like in the men's game where they come through academies and then they step up into, you know, Ireland under-20s and stuff, and there's a clear pathway there. That isn't there in the women's game. So we have to look at something else. And at the moment, it is the AIL. For years, I questioned the interpros and the purpose of the interpros. One situation of where they are in the year, three games, what's the point of them? Are players actually being looked at there? On top of that, I think Anthony Eddy's remit is huge, like sevens, women's, and he's also coaching. So that in itself is an issue. The fact that they keep saying that the women's programme is one big happy programme, it's clearly not. If you look at during the summer, they announced 28 sevens contracted players. 8 of them are over in Italy. 20 of them are not playing with their club. They didn't play in the Interpros. So what are they doing? There's no sevens competitions. So they should be getting as much game time as possible in the club or in Interpros, and they're not. So there's a huge big disconnect even at that high performance level, because there's girls training for nothing. And again, Rory said it there about the clubs being unhappy that their voice isn't heard. I know all the AIL clubs got together, gave suggestions and ideas to the IRFU about how things could be improved, and they didn't even get a reply. And, you know, the IRFU might be able to do it. There might be reasons behind it, but at least reply. If people, these are volunteers at AIL, they're giving up their time. They at least deserve the respect of a reply. Whether it's, yes, we can do it, or no, we can't, they deserve a reply.
And when was that, Fiona?
I think it was during the, at the start of the summer. It was before AIL kicked off anyway,
okay, so
before
the Interpros as well. Plenty of time to consider it and reply then, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about Adam Griggs?
Look, I think he's going to be the fall guy, to be honest with you. Obviously, there is questions asked about coaching, about selection. You know, you mentioned Claire McLoy's retirement, 74 caps. But for me, she is a world-class player. How a world-class player can't make, first of all, the squad in the Spanish game and then be on the bench. You talk to any other country, she's a player they try to keep out of the game. You get Claire Molloy out of the game, you're on a good winnings there. So for me, things like that, he'll be the fall guy. I don't see him resigning. He's in a contract, he's got a family and kids, and this is his job. So I don't see him resigning. So it's whether the IRFU are going to keep him till the end of the contract, which I presume was until after the World Cup. They have November internationals coming up. I don't think they're confirmed. I think it's USA and Japan, but I don't know if they're confirmed yet. So that's what he's going to be focusing on now.
Yeah, and he's perfectly entitled to do that. And based on everything that we're hearing, Rory, I mean, it's not like he's been given a great hand to play either, in fairness to him.
No, I think he made mistakes. And I think when he reflects on it, he will admit that he made mistakes. And we're not privy to how much of the decisions that he made were his decisions and how much of things were imposed. You know, here's seven sevens players because COVID's happening and there's nine, I think Fiona mentioned, are in Italy. Were they just presented to him and you've got to play these, they're contracted? Or did he go, these are the ones I want? I think there's a slight opacity between, you know, all of that. And obviously he works for the RFU, so he's limited in what he can say. He's a young coach who had a very good reputation going into the job, and this may damage him, but he shouldn't be thrown out of coaching. You know, he should be allowed to learn from this, but maybe he doesn't do it as the national coach of the women's team. Maybe he's redeployed into another role and they give it a fresh set of eyes. I think he should be pumped for every bit of information he has before he goes as part of the review. I think Claire Malloy should be, you know, like a phone call to Claire Malloy should be the first thing David Nussafour is doing now, because she's got so much experience. She was part of a winning structure. Now she's part of a structure that hasn't worked. What's the difference? What went wrong? And I think there has to be, like, there seems to be a public fear within Irish rugby of speaking out about these things. Even the fact that the Connacht women's squad, when they had to change beside the dressing rooms, were advised not to speak up about it, and eventually release a statement. Sorry, not the dressing rooms, the changing beside the, everyone knows about that a couple of weeks ago. I mean, why can't they speak up? Why can't they make their voices heard? What's so wrong about people making their voices heard for the betterment of Irish rugby? Like, this is a disaster for Irish rugby. We should have as many people like Fiona, like Grace Davitt, like Niamh Briggs, feeling free to come out and talk freely and to give their own opinions without fear of repercussion down the line, without fear that they won't be hired or picked for a job in the future. I mean, there should be, like, the committee structure we talked about, that's a construct of the Irish RFU. Like, there's nothing stopping them tearing that all apart and putting together the equivalent of a professional games board for women's rugby that has full control over all of this and holds Anthony Eddy and David Nussafour to account. And there's perfectly qualified people like Fiona who could be on that committee if she was willing to give her time, which I don't know if she would. But, you know, there are people out there who were part of a winning structure not that long ago who have a lot of IP, who, as far as I can tell from talking to many of them today, are not really being asked for their opinion, never mind listened to. Mm-hmm. And then there's other people who have ambitions to be within the game and to become coaches or and have jobs within the RFU who are almost afraid to speak honestly about this because they feel like if they do, it might be held against them when they go up for jobs in the future. And that's a really unhealthy place to be. And that goes back to the transparency point that I made earlier. And I often come in here and complain about the lack of transparency within the RFU. People should be comfortable coming out and saying, this is what I think should improve.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be personal. And if I say Adam Griggs, it shouldn't be a black mark against Adam Griggs. It hasn't worked out for him. He shouldn't be thrown out with the dishwater. You know, just because he failed at this doesn't mean he'll fail in the future. But, you know, he should be allowed to speak about what actually went wrong, where he felt he was held back. Because if he doesn't, the next guy will come in or the next woman will come in, and she will be operating with one hand behind her back, and that's not going to be healthy either.
Yeah, well, once he's certainly expressed himself behind the scenes, whatever about if they don't want it publicly, you can sort of appreciate that. But certainly he has to be listened to. Fiona, last word to you. So November internationals, potentially, but certainly a Six Nations around the corner. There's a bit of time to get their house in order just in terms of the match day performance ahead of a Six Nations. What would you like to see happen? So there's the coaching side of things, but just in terms of this team, like, confidence must be on the floor. We're talking about the same issues all the time, be it line out, errors, execution, game management, discipline. Like, they really have to address this now before the Six Nations.
Yeah, and I think the players in there have to come up with where it went wrong for them as well, and they need to be listened to, whether that's by Adam Griggs or whatever coach comes in. As I said, I think there's some quality players in there, and why they're not performing. Similar to 2017, I played with a number of them and knew they could perform, and then they didn't perform on the day. So what is that key thing that they're not, that's holding them back? And also a bit of consistency in the squad. Like, it's been chopped and changed. Every year we've gone into a Six Nations talking about transition. For 4 years we've spoken about transition. At a certain point there has to be a level of consistency, and we know what this team is about, how they're going to play. And that in itself will give confidence to the squad.
Okay, I suspect it's something we'll come back to. We're going to turn to the United Rugby Championship. Rugby here and Off the Ball is with thanks to Vodafone, proud sponsor of the Irish Rugby team. Hashtag team of us, everyone in. We had Leinster and Munster playing South African opposition, Rory. There is obviously huge hope that they will inject a bit of competitiveness, a touch of glamour, a touch of intrigue to this competition, which has always been a poor relation, unfortunately, and struggled for buy-in for huge parts of the season. realistically, the organisers would have been hoping for more from the Bulls at the Aviva, fresh from winning the Currie Cup. They lost to Leinster 31-3 in front of 20,000, and then Munster 42, Sharks 17 in front of 11,000 at Thomond. So they're not the scorelines to really grab people straight away and say, ooh, things have changed here.
Yeah, I think it's going to take time, and I think it's going to take a big cultural adjustment for the South African teams. And I think it's difficult because it's professional sport and your window is finite enough that you won't be really given time because the public have so much else to watch. I mean, like, look at this weekend, you know, you could watch Munster against the Sharks, but the Ryder Cup was on, and it obviously wasn't going particularly well for Europe, but a lot of people would have watched the first 15 minutes and gone, oh, well, I'm not missing much here because this is fairly one-sided. I do think there's promise. I think that certainly the Bulls, it was interesting to hear Donal Lennon on COCOMs or RTE talking about how the Sharks almost overestimated Munster and were almost afraid to... They're almost too respectful. And that might be just something that has to be washed out of the system as they go into these games and experience them, that when they start... they're so physically strong. They're not necessarily as fit, but they are physically strong. They're really physical teams. And I think once they get stuck into the Irish teams, they're going to cause them problems because that's where we've seen issues before. Like Jake White, I dealt into his press conference on Friday. I mean, I've never heard anyone wax lyrical as much as he did about Leinster. He was talking about this is the model, the Barcelona, I presume he means the previous Pep Guardiola iteration rather than the modern one, of European rugby. I mean, they're holding Leinster up on a massive parapet, but maybe they need to stop doing that and actually just kind of treat them as what they are, because it's a hugely experienced Bulls team. So I think over the next couple of weeks, there will be a settling in period. I don't think the hierarchy of the old Pro 14 is going to have changed substantially in this first year. I think Leinster and Munster are still the best two teams in the division. Ulster are probably third. I think the Bulls will come in somewhere around that, and then the other South Africans will fit in just as they go down. Depends on whether they get more resources to sign more players. I mean, there's 300 or 400 South Africans in Europe, and the Springboks are not in the squads. There's very few countries can deal with that sort of attrition rate and try and stay competitive. Leinster still have all the best Irish players, and Munster have the best Irish players. That's very hard for a South African team to compete against. Munster also have two of the best South Africans, you know, and one of their kind of best next rank down. So that's going to be a challenge for them. Yeah, I think it was a little bit underwhelming, but I wasn't necessarily hugely surprised by it. And like, if you look at the bookies' odds beforehand, I think the spread on Bulls was 25 points coming into the game. So no one's overly sold on the idea they're going to come in and start tearing up trees right away.
Fiona, I know you watched the Munster game, so 42 points to 17 against the Sharks. There was a real electricity about Thomond Park and excitement to be back naturally watching rugby. Orgie Sneeman comes in and plays, and so he's already had more minutes in one game than he had all of last season, which is good. It seems like Gavin Coombs was very impressive. It seems like Casey was very, very good, man of the match. And then, of course, you have Zyman Zeebo, and like, that's such an exciting prospect now for Munster, and he's going to put bums on seats. So it seemed like, in fairness, pretty good opening night for Munster, all told.
Look, 6 tries, you know, fans back in the stadium, Zeebo with a smile on his face going down the wing. That's what the fans are looking for. And, you know, they were a bit ring rusty in parts. The game did get sloppy. But there was a little bit of intent at times to look for that wider game, and I think having Zeebo there, they'll certainly look for that more as the season goes through. And as you said, players stepping up, no second season syndrome, the likes of Coombs, you know, he's continuing on the form that he had last season. Craig Casey, outstanding. It's going to be an interesting battle when Conor Murray comes back, because, you know, Casey's on form at the moment and they want to play with that kind of tempo, and he might be the player for them. Obviously they'll develop as well. There's been a lot of talk about Larkham taking more control of their attack, so that'll be interesting to see how it actually develops, and particularly when the likes of Diolande comes back into the back line as well, to what level that they can get to get the likes of Zeebo on the ball as much as possible. But like, a first good day out, it's, I suppose, they've never really disappointed early on in the season. No. In the previous Pro 14, it's just at the business end of the season whether they now have this squad and develop this squad to push on, and whether the likes of Sneeman, actually we see a huge amount of him, and like, he's a colossal man. Didn't see a huge amount of him in the 17 minutes that he was on, but hopefully as the season goes on, we'll really see what he's about.
As Fiona rightly says, Rory, there's always talk Munster this time of the year of the game plans evolving, and that happened again, and there's talk of Larkham taking more control, and there was talk like that last year, and they quickly reverted to type when the pressure came on. So is there anything based on what you've seen or heard thus far that gives you a certain hope that they may actually follow through here? Because It does be. It is an early season typical Munster story.
Yeah, and the weather's good as well, which obviously opens it up to playing that sort of game. Whereas Thomond Park in December is a very hard place to play open rugby.
Yeah,
and I do think that over the time, that almost they win those tight games, and they almost fool themselves into thinking this is what we have to do to win the big games, because they play those European games around December, January in tough conditions, and they play a tight game, and then by the time they get to April, May, they've almost convinced themselves that that box kick chase game is the way to go. And they all, like, there is this clash of culture behind the scenes at Munster between the South African Van Graan, the English forwards coach Graham Rowntree, and the Australian tactician Stephen Larkham, and it's really, really intriguing as to who wins out almost in that battle. Because it's been Van Graan so far. Certainly we've seen signs of Larkham's influence at times, and Van Graan is, you know, had a reputation as being a very innovative coach when he was with South Africa. But it does feel like every time, a bit like Jacques Nienaber, you know, his predecessor in the Munster job, and Razzy Erasmus with South Africa, when the pressure comes on, they tend to tighten up and go for the low percentage plays like those kick chase games. But what a shame it would be to have Simon Zeebo in your squad and then to make him chase kicks all day. And I think it won't be enough for them. The problem they have is that their tight five isn't good enough to win a game in that way. They have good players there, but they don't have the size. Even what Leinster are trying to do in reconstituting their front row, it's all to do with trying to win those collisions. Munster don't really have that in their tight five. They have very good second row ball carriers. They've lost CJ Stander, so they have, like, their talent is almost in their back line. If you put Conor Murray, Joey Carberry, Damien Dialende, Chris Farrell, Simon Zeebo, Andrew Conway and Keith Earls in the same back line, throw Mike Haley in, you know, you've got like unbelievable talent there. Yeah. So what's the point in making them chase kicks? You've got to play, especially when the ground hardens up and we get back to this level again. So I think they won't win anything doing this way, I don't think. I think ultimately they'll run into a Leinster or a La Rochelle or a Toulouse, and they will fall short. So although they did play good rugby against Toulouse last year and lost the shootout, so, you know, they could point to that. So, but I do think this is the way they need to go. Whether they persevere with it is the big question.
I'm all for the season-long duel between Simon Zeebo and Keith Earls. So with his two tries, Zeebo with 62 tries is all-time top scorer. Keith Earls is on 59. So I look forward to those not passing to each other when there's a potential for a try. On Leinster, Fiona, this Keane Healy-Andrew Porter situation is very interesting. Give us your read on it.
I think it's about looking at longevity, how long Keane Healy has left in the tank to play, and the youth of Porter coming over, and that's where he played originally, so it's just putting him back there. I think that's pretty much it, and just the explosiveness that Porter brings, like that front row is hugely exciting of Porter, Kelleher and Furlong when they all get going. So I think it's got to do with an age profile and how long and what impact Keane Healy can make during the season.
What do you think, Rory, about more so, less so for Porter, who obviously is
such a challenge for Keane Healy? Yeah. Like, I mean, the idea of a player at that level, at that stage of his career, learning a completely new position. I think Fiona can correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I understand it, from my own limited experience, switching from tight head to loose head is not as difficult as switching from loose head to tight head. I mean, he's got a whole different experience that he's going through, and Andrew Porter was a loose head when he started, so it's much easier for him. He's going back to what he knew first of all, and he's played even an international game at that level, whereas as far as I know, Keane Healy's never really played a tight head, unless he did when we only had one sub and he had to come on for a few minutes at the end of a game back in like 2009-2010, which is a long time ago. It's all about power. It's all about getting it's longevity and power. I think it's getting the most out of your players and getting your best players on the pitch, so when you play La Rochelle and you're faced up with Will Skelton or Winnie Antonio, you have that combination of Porter, Kelleher and Furlong, and then you're able to bring off the bench Michael Alalatoa and Keane Healy and Dan Sheehan. You know, you've got, I mean, Healy's on the loose outside in that scenario, but you know, it's giving you options, and it's also giving Leo Cullen said he watched the Springboks and Trevor and Kaina playing both sides during the Lions tour, and thought this is a great idea. So he has Porter to be able to do both, and potentially Healy to do both. Like, it's an incredible mark of Healy's talent that he's able to do this at this age of his career.
Yeah. So Fiona, it's for Healy, the challenge presumably is not in loose play at all. They can, that's fairly similar. It's just the technique in the scrum. How difficult do you suspect it will be?
Yeah, hugely. A tight head is a far more difficult position to play, and particularly when you've picked up the habits of playing loose head, and you're just so comfortable with playing loose head, to switch over and then not have, you know, that, I suppose, freedom with your head out. It's just so much more technical, and you're being targeted by two players as well, you know, so it's a whole new learning curve for him. But it'll be interesting to see whether how long they persist with the tight head, him as a sub first of all, but as a tight head sub, or whether he'll just be able to flick between both and but concentrate predominantly on loose head, because realistically, how many years has he got left? Do you know? I think they'd be far better off just him as a loose head replacement, to be honest.
Okay, interesting. Clock's coming against us. So Ulster with the bonus point win against Glasgow, 35-29. John Cooney, hamstring injury. Billy Burns went off injured as well. As for Connacht, they were the losing Irish province, lost to Cardiff, 33 points to 21. They don't have a great record in Cardiff traditionally. They were 6 points up at the 40-minute mark. Discipline hurt them, bit of precision here or there, and they let the game slip. It was quite interesting, Fiona, reading Bernard Jackman in the Sunday Independent yesterday, and he was writing his column from Bristol Airport at 7:10 a.m., You're back. The old phone dropping. He was writing his column at 7:10 a.m. in Bristol Airport, and he was sharing the terminal with the Connacht players who had obviously played the night before, and they were getting the red-eye flight, and some of them were lying out trying to catch a bit of sleep. And he was just making the point, you know, they would have got to bed if they were lucky maybe after midnight, up at 4 a.m. for a flight home. If it was Leinster over in Cardiff, there'd be a charter flight home. They'd wake up in their beds. They, you know, all of this stuff adds up, and all the provinces have to cut 10% off their budget. For Connacht, that will hurt even more. Plus, there's probably a lack of depth in the squad ultimately. Plus, he was making the point that there won't be as many games during the international windows, which would have been a period where Connacht could make hay with other provinces losing more players. And it's harder to make the Champions Cup in this new format. So this could be difficult to ish season for Connacht, and they didn't get off to a great start. Interestingly, they have the Sharks coming up next. So we saw the Sharks against, the Bulls. It was one of the South Africans. They have the Bulls on Friday in Galway. So that's a really interesting game to see where both sides are after a disappointing opening week.
Yeah, look, I think Andy Friend has always spoke about how difficult it is for Connacht with regards to resources, particularly when he's going out to the market looking for players and what type of players that he's capable within the budget. And, you know, then that extends to not having charter flights. You're talking about recovery for players, particularly if they were injured players after that game. It doesn't bode well for them. But one of their biggest thing has been the lack of consistency from game to game, from week to week. You know, they pull it out of the drawer in some games and then the next week they just fall apart. So I think that's certainly something that he needs to build on this season, is consistency, and hopefully that he can keep as many people injury free as possible. Obviously the two yellow cards killed them last week. But in saying that, Cardiff lost two out-halves through injury and were still able to pull it out of the bag. So I think Andy Friend will be looking for consistency and performance, particularly with a home game against them. You know, but it's still a difficult task. I don't think the Sharks were too exciting against Munster, but if Connacht don't come out and perform, I think that the Sharks could win it.
Is it the Bulls or the Sharks?
Bulls, yeah.
Bulls, sorry. Yeah.
But I think that's a real good test of where Connacht are at. And like, Cardiff are a good team. I think Cardiff will cause a lot of teams problems this year. But Connacht at home to the Bulls is a really, really good measure of where Connacht are, but also where the South Africans are. But yeah, Connacht have been screwed by the new season format. Like, you know, they have to play the three best teams in the tournament more than everyone else. Yeah. Like an extra round against each of them.
For them to finish in the top eight is therefore much more difficult.
It'll be some achievement if they do it. And having lost Quinn Roo, who I think when you're playing against South African teams is the one player you didn't want to lose. Yeah. You know, ball carrying, you know, scrummaging second row from Pretoria. He would have been very handy this season, but he's with Toulon and they've replaced him with a bit of a wild card signing as they've had to do in the last couple of years. So it's a challenge. It's going to be a challenging season for Connacht, and they've got a very good coach who is good at facing up to these challenges. But if they manage to get into that top eight, they'll have done very, very well.
Okay. Rory O'Connor from the Irish Independent, thanks so much for coming in. Fiona Coughlin, Grand Slam winning Irish international, thanks very much, guys.
Monday night rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.